something spoke. You know, the Lord of my soul spoke, or my soul itself spoke. And I realized I didn't have to keep trying to be something I wasn't, that it was okay to be who I am.
Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. You are in the cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our bonnet boat was won as we sailed into the mystic.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the soulful terrain on the far side of conventional religion. Welcome. The question of vocation, who we are and what we are called to do with our lives, is not just a question for the young. In fact, the question often doesn't fully emerge until midlife, by which time we've already made decisions based on who the world wants us to be and what the world wants us to do. That's why we call it a midlife crisis. We've answered the question of vocation for the sake of others, but have we answered it for the sake of our own souls? Approaching midlife, writer and filmmaker Celia McBride thought she was supposed to become someone else, a Roman Catholic nun. The fact that she was neither Catholic nor, for that matter, baptized, did not deter her from following this calling as far as she could. She's got spunk. But where it led was not where she thought it was leading. Soul seldom does what we expect. Soul has its own plan for our lives. This is her fascinating story. Celia, you emerge from the pages of your memoir as a kind of creative, self-starting, independent, a woman with agency who kind of knows her own mind and perhaps goes her own way, such that a vocation to the religious life seemed not impossible at all, but unlikely. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking we might start there. Tell me a little about that sense of vocation to the religious life, and especially as that is modeled by the figure of a nun.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. It's true. I mean, people who know me, who even just hear that I was considering religious life, kind of go, what? Like, it does seem kind of incongruous to some degree. I mean, other people who know me in other circles might say, oh yeah, I totally get it. You know, the book ends in January 2016, so it's July 2023 right now. So I have had a lot of time to reflect on what the heck that was all about. And I think some of it, I think it's a two-parter. I think some of it is, you know, deep down, I have this profound love for the great mystery, for what we cannot know, what we cannot explain, and you know, for lack of a better word, God. There is I am a lover of that experience. I am a lover of that reality. And I think part two is I am a perfectionist. You know, not in a good way, although it has served me, certainly. But I look back and I think, wow, spiritual perfectionism and the desire to be a saint was probably motivating a lot of what was happening. Yeah. And I think really they're in combination with each other is, you know, I love this mystery. How do I connect to this mystery in the deepest possible way? And, you know, how do I be the best, get it right, go to the top, all of the above.
There's also, though, a part of you that emerges as the contemplative. That's part of the mix, and that part made sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I always forget that part. Yes, there is also in me a desire for that experience that contemplation or the contemplative life offers, which has to do with deep silence, which has to do with solitude, which has to do with being in oneness or union with some kind of divine experience, or just, one reality experience. So yeah, that is for sure intrinsic to my being as well.
Yeah. Well, another anomaly of the memoir, which you put right up front, is the fact that you didn't grow up with God language in your household. It wasn't, or with religious practice. So tell me a little bit about your childhood as it relates to the eventual development of this sense of vocation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so interesting to have sort of religion around me in that, if you're, I sort of say this in the book, if you're white and your last names on both sides are English, Irish, Scottish, or French, you're probably Christian. And so, you know, Christianity was around me, but not in the home. Yeah. And so I was picking up on it, probably informed by it to some degree, and yet no practice was happening at the dinner table on Sundays. It just wasn't a thing. And yet, because it was around and because it was a conversation that would sort of seep in through the Lord's Prayer in school, through friends going to church, through, you know, my mother had been raised in and out of different Christian denominations. I think her mother wrestled with Christianity. My mother certainly wrestled with it. I knew some things, and some of them were attractive to me. And so there was almost I do say this in the book as well, like I had nothing to rebel against. So yeah. I went looking for it. You know, other people would be like, I'm done with this. I don't want anything to do with this anymore. But I was curious about it. I was like, well, what is this? Who is this Jesus character? And what is this God thing? And so it sort of became something to find out about rather than reject or run away from.
And didn't you go to church with a young friend? Like, I'm thinking you're like 5, 6 years old, something like that, and you went off to their church, which then would have been a strange new world.
It was. And honestly, I don't remember the experience other than the family story that is now, you know, part of legend that I came home and tried to convert the whole family.
At 5 years old, is that?
At five. Something happened. I mean, I was within, you know, one church service, a holy roller. I don't know.
Wow. You were open. You were wide open.
It was wide open. Yeah, that's true. Thank you also for saying that, because I think one of my qualities is openness. What is this? I want to know. And you know, give this to me, please. It looks amazing.
Yeah. A friend of mine who's a podcaster, and I've been on her show and she's been on my show, her show is Tracking Yes, and it's all about curiosity.
Yeah.
And it was like a reintroduction for me of that word when I was talking with her about it. I thought, that's sort of the basis of all faith, isn't it? Like curiosity. It isn't knowledge. It's being curious enough to take a step in its direction. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels like that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is this? I want to learn about this. I want to know about this. The people that are fighting it, debating it. I just want to find out what's going on here.
Yeah. Also then, at an early age, you began exploring your creativity, because that has become a central theme in your adult life, that you have a need to create stuff.
Yeah.
Not just to take it in, but to put something out.
Yes.
So, because that's not the focus of the memoir, but I'd love to hear a little bit about the development of your creative intuitions, because it opened certain paths for you in what you've done as an adult.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that comes from my mother. She was a writer, is a writer, and a painter. And she encouraged that certainly in me, perhaps in my three sisters as well. But there was a typewriter in the basement, and she was clacking away writing a novel. And when she wasn't on the typewriter, I would go down and clack away on my novel, which was the length of a short story, but still. And, when I would draw or paint, she would tell me that it was wonderful. I was very outgoing. I was sort of a clown. And, I had one teacher she used to call me Joan Rivers. And, so that I told my mother I wanted to be an actress. And she said, well, your whole life is an act. You'll do great. And so, I was encouraged. My creativity was really encouraged. And then I think I just started to believe that it was, talking about this question of vocation and call. I think I'm saying that because I just listened to your podcast with talking about Thomas More's book. This question of vocation and call, I felt, because I had been encouraged, I felt, oh, this is who I am. So I need to live this out in some way.
And which you've done across genres, because you're a playwright and a filmmaker and a writer, of course, and also a visual artist.
Yes.
So really the creativity has found lots of outlets.
It really has. And, someone asked me the other day if I was a dancer. And, I want to say, yes, I am a dancer. I'm not a professional dancer, but I wanted to be a dancer when I was a kid. I mean, that was my first love. And so, yes, the creative energy moves through me. And I really try to give it as much space as I can.
Yeah. This is going out on a limb a bit, but it was a perception for me of reading the memoir. And so I put it together with the vocation of the religious life. You have lots of friends. You have a social network you're part of. But at the heart of that, there felt to me like a kind of a solitariness.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was a loneliness, but you'd have to say that. I'm not sure it was, but a solitariness. And I wondered if that wasn't part of the journey that made residential community, so a living in community, an attractive thing for you. Mm-hmm. Am I reading that right?
That's a very interesting question. I would say certainly the solitariness is something that I feel more attracted to than community. I would say, yes, loneliness is a big part of my experience. I have felt very lonely over the course of my life until, I would say probably until I got sober and found sober communities where I was like, oh, this is, I'm not, there's loneliness is, I don't have to be lonely, actually. My attraction to religious life, I think this is one of the reasons why I had so many rude awakenings when I started to explore religious life, was that it came with community.
Yeah. Yes.
And
yes.
I was like, oops, I'm not sure. I didn't really think this was part of it. And I remember that happened very definitively in a monastic community I was in for a month in Ireland, where one of the sisters said to me, I think you're romanticizing this. You know, you think this is about you and God being alone together in this love affair. But, you know, hello, we're over here and we got to make meals together and we got to try to organize the community together and we're going to get on each other's nerves and you're not going to like us. And that was a bit of a wake-up call, actually. I had yeah. been romanticizing this idea of what it meant to be a monk.
Well, but still, you dove in with the Sisters of Contemplation in England and were there for a number of months. And I think that's really where you were testing out the call. And what comes through the memory, Celia, you loved it. I mean, there was something about that you loved, even when it meant kind of breaking through the resistance of one of the sisters who may have resented your presence at the start. But you loved the work because they were connected with a senior's home.
Yes.
And they were, and it's lovely to read. Is it Bernadette? Was she the superior?
She was.
Because she saw something in you. And she wasn't going to let you go that easily because okay. she's so, you know, whether it was that this was, as so many religious orders, their days were numbered. And here comes this bright young thing into their midst with all these ideas.
Yeah.
So let's focus on that experience because that you were really committed to testing it out when you were there.
I really was. This is this question. What is call? What does that mean? What are we even talking about? You know, the pull was so strong to be a monk. And you know, because I was exploring Christianity at the time and having mystical experiences, I thought that Christianity was the container through which to walk. And yet, I wrestled with institutionalized, organized religion, in this case, Christianity. And yet I felt this pull. And so I had to give it everything that I had. And yes, Sister Bernadette saw something in me and I loved, there were so many things that I did love, you know.
Let's talk about that because it comes through. It comes through that there was an element of this life you could have lived had that been your destiny.
Yeah, I think so. I really, and I think that's why it was so agonizing because there was this profound love happening and yet this lack of I just couldn't understand why my value, well, I could understand why my values were being rubbed the wrong way and yet I couldn't reconcile the two. It's like, how can this be? How can this be so? So what, you know, we'd walk across to this chapel every morning to go to daily mass and you know, at the time I had my head was shaved, which was part of my monastic, I guess me trying to live out, austerity and lack of, you know, vanity. And so it was cold in the chapel. So I'd wrap my shawl over my head and I felt like I was sort of wearing a veil and I would kneel on the kneeler and, you know, look up at this statue of Jesus, which had blood painted on his knees. And the priest would come out and it was a very intimate mass. I mean, there were sort of 10 of us there every day. And I just loved it. I loved saying the words back to the priest. I loved the depth of prayer that I was giving myself to and receiving. Often I would find myself weeping. I mean, I just felt extremely privileged and extremely connected to something greater than myself that felt like love and compassion and mercy.
Even through what would have been the some of the difficult personalities, I'm thinking one in particular with whom you were living, there was a depth of love for each one of them. Mm-hmm. And the one that you were living with close to when you were doing the work at the seniors' home, mm-hmm. She came to love you.
Yeah.
You could see her breaking down.
Yes.
And when it appeared that you may not be staying, she just closed the door again. As a reader, you feel all this because you were so committed to say, you may not like me now, honey, but I'm in here for the long haul. There was a lovely exchange of unconditional love. And that changes a person. And my sense was, oh, you were opening her heart as much as your heart was being opened.
Yeah. I can feel my heart breaking as you mention her sister Ita, because I still feel that is actually one of the losses that I continue to grieve, which is, you know, I left her. I had to leave. The community was not the right fit. I was, you know, my calling to monastic life was not in that configuration. I had to leave, but it meant I had to leave her.
Yeah.
And if I could have stayed, like if I could have sacrificed me for her, I mean, I was prepared to do it. I really was. I was like, I will die so that this woman does not have to be alone, and so that this woman does not have to feel like no one loves her. I will give up everything so that she can have someone. And I couldn't do it. I mean, I just couldn't be that sacrificial martyr. But I wanted to because I adored her, even though she scolded me and I could never do anything to make her happy. And she was so ornery and, you know, I think wounded. I mean, she was, you know, I think she was 18 or 17 when a country girl from Ireland, it's when she entered and, you know, all her community was gone. She was really like one of the last ones. And I just felt her grief immensely. And I wanted to make it better.
Yeah.
Not my job, though.
Not your job, but it comes through that your heart was just open to her, and to hear you talk about her now, which is, you know, what we're talking about 7 years later, you know, that still
7 years later.
I think we have to go back and talk about baptism, because if we're going to talk about your reservations and concerns about the Catholic Church as an institution, so when you said you went off to Mass every morning, you were not receiving Communion.
I was not. I was crossing my arms.
That's right. And you had certain pressure being put on you about, come on over, join us, you know, just get baptized. But you had already had a baptism of sorts. Let's talk about that baptism, what that meant to you, and why that seemed some impediment to a Catholic baptism.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That feels like an entire, I feel like we could have an entire episode I'm talking about, you know, what feels to me like the injustice of who gets to receive Holy Communion and who doesn't. And so I had what I call a mystical baptism experience after a profound healing session, a spiritual direction healing session with someone who you happen to have interviewed, Lois Huey Heck. She was the spiritual director on a retreat I went to at the Naramata Center. We had a session where I feel like we healed a really huge piece of my trauma background. And at the end of the session, we got quiet. She said, Celia, what wants to happen now? Which is a really good spiritual direction question. I am a spiritual director and I use it often. And I heard this inner prompt say, go jump in the lake. And I could have laughed and said, oh, you know, the inner prompt is having a laugh with me. But I took it seriously. And Lois and I, in hysterics, sent me off down to the water. And I walked in to the water naked. And I, before I plunged under the water, I said something like, the girl who doesn't believe she deserves love is no more. And I went under the water and I came back up. And when I got my clothes back on and walked back to the Naramata Center, I laughed to myself thinking, I've just been baptized. Like I'd just been, that was a baptism. And that was enough for me, but that doesn't even come close to counting in the Catholic Church. Now, there were Catholics who said, well, what a wonderful story. And so one sister called it a baptism of desire, but none of that was enough to make it legal for me to receive the Eucharist.
Well, it's because there's those two dimensions. I mean, the technical definition of a sacrament, including baptism, is an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. Full stop. It doesn't say a priest has to administer it. Yeah. And what you describe in Naramata, in the lake, is an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. Mm. However, the church also has said, and this outward and visible sign shall also be the doorway to membership. Yeah. So when we administer it, you're a member. Until then, you can call yourself an inquirer or many other things, but you're not a Christian.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, again, 7 years later, looking back, you know, knowing myself on a deeper level, having done more inner work, becoming more trauma-informed, I see that block to me, like, no, you can't do this. You can't have this. You're not allowed. Well, that just fired up this part of me that desperately wanted belonging. Yeah. And how do you discern call when somewhere tangled in that mess is a desire to belong and a refusal to allow belonging to happen? And I think that was because, you know, my discernment was not to become a nun at that time. I, as Sister Bernadette said to me, Celia, you need to discern whether to become a Catholic first. And I was like, oh, yeah. I got the order wrong here. So then that became my question, is do I convert to Catholicism? And that is really what I ended up wrestling with. I think it, if it had been, are you discerning whether to become a monk, and the monastic life that you are discerning is all welcoming, interspiritual, allows you to be yourself completely, I don't think there would have been any issue. I would have thought, yep, yeah, I'm called to be a monk. It's pretty clear to me. Let's go. Yeah. But there were all of these other ways that I went through that hoop, that monk hoop. And that was a really big one, is I want to belong and I don't belong here. And I'm going to fight this thing and surrender to this thing at the same time.
A friend of mine who was also an Anglican priest used to say, we have to distinguish between the church as an institution and the church as the mystical body of Christ. Mm-hmm. Because most of us who are idealists only really want to acknowledge the mystical body of Christ, right, as the reality. But the pension fund gets paid through the institution. Yeah. The collar you wear around your neck, it's given to you by the institution. Your authority to preside at the Mass. So there's a very difficult tension within the church about the institution and the mystical body of Christ. Because the mystical body of Christ, the angels would have been saying amen over your baptism in the lake.
Yeah.
But the church fathers might have been going, I don't know. This isn't the real thing. Where's the priest?
Exactly.
It is an issue that I want to get to your resolution of that, but I don't want to move too quickly because I think this is absolutely key. The number of people who feel a sense of personal faith, mm-hmm. but they're no longer willing to have that filtered exclusively through the doctrines and practices of the institutional church.
Yeah. I really think it is such a important conversation, and I've just met so many people on the journey and now who've read the book, who are having this conversation, who have this longing for this mystical body of whatever, and just balk at the institutionalization of the sacred, just don't actually want to have anything to do with it.
Are you aware? I wish I'd thought to bring the book so I had it in front of me. There's a whole movement called the New Monasticism. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I am. And that the community that I lived with in France were a new monastic community.
It seems they're trying to redefine monasticism. So there doesn't have to be an institutional structure, nor does there have to be necessarily a residential component mm-hmm. where you can belong and take some vows that help define your life and that is very committed, as many religious communities are, to work in the world. Yeah. So it's like there are people like yourself who are continuing to there's some idea here which is worth preserving. Mm-hmm. If only we can find a new way to do it.
Yeah. And there are people doing it. I mean, the Northumberland community in the UK is the community that I found who are practicing new monasticism. Christine Valtner's Paintner, who writes The Monk in the World, blog and has, you know, a whole community following her. Yeah, they're out there. I'm forgetting his name right now, Shane something, but he's sort of more of a radical new monastic through the Quaker community in the U.S. It's definitely a conversation and a practice that is continuing to evolve.
Yeah. But it didn't help you with your dilemma. Mm-mm. You had been to Teze, and so you had a sense of there are other possibilities. But by then in your story, I think the dream was beginning to come apart. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that, because it was painful. You came back to Canada thinking, maybe I'll return. Pick up the story from there about how you came to the conclusion, no, at least not this community, not now.
Yeah. It's hard to come right to that point without saying what came before it. But I remember the moment where I was on my knees, sort of begging for some kind of relief and some kind of final answer. You know, I'd just been going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I think I said something like, you know, which I've been saying probably many times already, you know, why are you making me do this kind of thing? And what came was, you're misunderstanding. This is not a requirement. If you desire this, of course. But if you don't have to do this. You know, this is just this kind of like, oh, I've misunderstood. You know, yeah. I've actually.
And who was speaking?
You know, I mean, I have all kinds of ideas about where those words come from. I think there is a higher part of me. I think however this mystery God works, it speaks. I think there is a also just a loving mother inside of me, inside of us all. You know, maybe the parent that didn't say those words so sweetly that you needed. So, I mean, I don't know, but I, at the time, I was praying to the Lord, and I would have said it felt like the Lord. Now I would say the Lord is like, we don't even know what the Lord is. This is not one thing. This is not, you know, the Lord doesn't look like you think it looks like. So something spoke, you know, the Lord of my soul spoke, or my soul itself spoke. And I realized I didn't have to keep trying to be something I wasn't, that it was okay to be who I am. And that everything that I was searching for, everything that I was trying to become, I already was, I already am. And that was the moment where I said, okay, it's enough, Celia. You can stop now. You can relax.
Wow. And then, of course, coming to that point, you decided you had to go back and say your proper goodbyes, mm-hmm. which honored that whole part of the journey. It honored the people that were part of your life. But I'll bet that tore your heart out.
It did. And I even thought, I can stay. And mostly, again, it was about Sister Ida. I was like, I can do this. I can stay. I mean, I just could not bear to break her heart. So, and I also have people who've read the book that say, I can't believe you went back. You know, one person was like, you're crazy. Another person said, oh, you know, you really are a person of integrity. I went back into the fire to leave properly and to say, I really stand in my power, stand my ground and say, thank you, but no thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what has evolved since? You were doing work, and we haven't talked about this, but it is a theme that one of your apparent callings is to work with seniors.
Mm-hmm.
And that was throughout the book, and that's what made the fit with the Sisters of Contemplation such a good fit, because that was the work you were doing. Has that continued?
It has, through a series of quite miraculous events. I became the spiritual care provider at a long-term care facility here in Port Hope, where I live. That, again, I did not make that happen. I mean, I could not have orchestrated that if I had tried. That was literally handed to me on a plate. And I continue to provide spiritual care for the elderly and the dying. And not everyone in long-term care is elderly. So, you know, disabled and, you know, people struggling with physical capacity. I advocate for seniors. I'm working right now with a number of people in the community who are trying to prevent a massive long-term care institution from being built here. And I'm sort of finding myself as the poster child for long-term care reform, which, you know, again, is an accident. I didn't start doing that. And you know, here I am in the world, in a relationship, practicing trying to honor that part monk that I am while, you know, being a human being and a woman in relationship with a man, I share a house with my parents. It's an adventure. And yeah. I would say I've let go of a lot of the rigidity that was keeping me bound to an idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was absolutely lovely, actually, when you said, I don't have to be trying so hard. Yeah. No one's putting A and B in front of me and I have to choose A or B. That's me.
That's me.
That life is calling. Life was calling you to something else. And what it was calling you to would appear to be quite rich enough mm-hmm. without needing to make all the renouncements you would to be within a Catholic religious community. I'm going to ask you the question, are you still baptized merely by your own baptism of desire? Has there been an institutional baptism?
There has not. And actually, I have a client, and he features in the book at the end when I say, you know, well, I'll let you read the book, but he's a Catholic priest, and we went out the other day, and we went out for a drive in the country, and he was showing me, you know, where he's from, and I thought, maybe we're going to stop somewhere, and we're going to have this moment where he finally says, okay, am I going to do it? Can I do it? And will I say yes? But it hasn't happened yet. The mystical baptism is holding. Is holding. It's holding.
What do you make now, and this must come up in the spiritual direction you do, what do you make now of the whole notion of vocation?
Well, I feel like it's a mystery. I feel like each person needs to discern for themselves what that is. If I were to make a statement on behalf of us all, which is a little presumptuous, but I would say I feel like we are all called to become ourselves. So the calling that I was experiencing and misinterpreting as becoming something was actually to become myself. And I'm still, that's new every day. I mean, I landed in myself in 2016 when I left the community. And, you know, then I landed in myself in starting a relationship in 2019. And, you know, I recently just landed in myself when I realized I need more independence than I have right now. So this calling, vocation, I would still say, which I say in the book, mine is touching lives. I would still say that. And yet I would also say to continue healing, to continue letting go, to continue being curious, trusting. It's not one thing, I think maybe is where I have arrived. It's not one thing. It's not in a box. For me, I mean, you know, it might be one thing for you, and that's for you to decide.
And it never ends.
It never ends.
It's like you never arrive. You never get there.
That's it.
And even if you do, then, like, the book is subtitled An Unbecoming Journey, which is fabulous, by the way, fabulous writing, An Unbecoming Journey. Because when we do grasp onto something as being there, that's what I'm called to be.
Yeah.
In your experience in the book, that's where unbecoming comes into play, is that I have to let go of that self, of that person, because that's only a portion of the real of what's true, right?
Exactly. And it keeps changing. That first year after I left, that year 2016, I remember experiencing, and these are the words I used, I said, I am experiencing an unprecedented inner freedom. And I thought it was going to last forever. I mean, I literally thought I had arrived at an inner freedom that was always going to be with me. You know, that was 2016. 2021, I experienced an illness and I was in the depths of depression. So dark. Every tool, every spiritual practice I'd ever employed didn't seem at my fingertip, just gone. And I thought, well, you know, here we are. And it just, we don't get to stay, it seems, in, you know, the unbecoming continues, the allowing for life, for soul to indicate what's next continues. And, you know, that's the scary part, is we just, we don't have a lot of control here.
It's like the disciples on the mount for the transfiguration, and they wanted to build tents.
Yes.
Hey, this is so cool, Jesus. We could all just live here.
That's
you
it.
Know, you and Moses and Elijah, like this is so. And Jesus is going, come on, down from the mountain, down to the valley. This is where we live.
Yeah, he's not having any of it. And then the cloud comes in, and it's like, oh, they know nothing. We're just in this cloud of unknowing. Here it is.
Celia, it was very courageous of you to tell that story. It's a very honest story. And because of that, it can't help but to engage a reader at a deep level. So I want to thank you for the book, and it's so well written too. I think I told you, I read it at a very busy time in my life thinking, how am I going to squeeze this in? Well, in fact, it became my little retreat. I went to your book every day, and it was my way of retreating from all the busyness and just dwelling in this place of discovery. So it's a lovely book. I'm going to, in the show notes, I will reference your website. So if people want to be able to buy a copy, they can do that online.
Thank you.
You said to me that you had been thinking of maybe even started writing a sequel, but it was like, okay, enough about me. And now you're moving on to other projects. What are you doing now?
Yeah, exactly. I really want to tell, there's so many incredible stories of that year, 2016. And I wanted to, I still want to write that book. It's The Journey Continues, and it's pretty amazing. But I did, I thought, I just can't keep, this is enough about me for sure. So I'm trying my hand at a novel, which is what I've always wanted to do. And if you read the book, there's a section where I end up in Edmonton working in a Chinese restaurant, being spoken to by cosmic consciousness. And the novel, it starts there, and it's got multiverses and talking spiders. And I'm actually having a lot of fun because I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm just sort of allowing, trusting that every other person that's written a novel didn't know what they were doing either. And somehow this vast creative intelligence that makes music through us and writes novels through us is doing this.
Well, Celia, thank you for the book, but also thanks for talking with me and exploring this whole notion, which feels vast. It feels like this, even just as a topic, vocation is something that it's open-ended, not closed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Such a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me for my conversation with Celia McBride. Her memoir, Oh My God, An Unbecoming Journey, as well as links to her other work, can be found in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links to my website where you can sign up to receive the blog that accompanies each new episode of The Mystic Cave. And wherever you find your podcasts, please give the show a rating. This helps others to find us. Next time, I'll be speaking with Kevin Alderson about sexuality and the spiritual journey. How does one affect the other? especially if our sexuality has been judged or denied by those who gave us spiritual care, what does that do to our souls? Alderson, a practicing psychologist, a professor emeritus of counseling psychology specializing in LGBTQ+ issues, and the author of 11 nonfiction books, will help us out. I hope you'll join us. I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.